Welcome. I'm Mark Hertzgard, and this is Your Call. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar this week. And we have a special edition of the Media Roundtable this Friday. We're going live to the Paris Climate Summit. It's about halfway through the two-week summit. President Obama, Chinese President Xi, and the other heads of state have come and gone, and they left behind their delegations to try to negotiate an agreement among almost 200 nations represented in Paris. And in addition to those delegations, the halls are pulsing with hundreds of NGOs from the climate justice movement, many scientific and business organizations, leaders of city and state governments, including California's own Governor Jerry Brown, and at least 3,000 journalists. And on this special edition of the Media Roundtable, we're going to be talking to two of them, two of the best. Live from Paris at the UN Climate Summit, joining us are Mark Shapiro. He's a veteran environmental journalist and author of the book Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy. Mark Shapiro is filing for Newsweek and the Internews Environmental Reporting Network from Paris. And also joining us is Jack Cushman. He's an editor and reporter with Inside Climate News, Pulitzer Prize-winning nonprofit news organization, and he's in Paris reporting for them. Gentlemen, good evening there in Paris. Thanks for joining us, Mark Shapiro and Jack Cushman.
Good to be here.
Very nice to be here.
Okay. So, as you know, and welcome back to the program. I think both of you guys have been on before, and as you know, therefore, we always like to try and start off with what's the best story that you've seen that you didn't do yourselves this week coming out of the Paris Climate Summit? Mark Shapiro, why don't you start?
Well, I'll tell you something. I basically have I picked up this issue of the I don't have a lot to say about the last kind of day or two because I've just been going crazy trying to figure out what's going on. But actually, on my way out of town, I picked up this issue of the New Republic, actually, of last week, which is actually extremely useful. It's the cover story called Future Proofing the Planet. They have a whole series of stories about climate change. There's a great story about the rising seas in Miami and the effort of the people in Miami to deal with essentially what they're discovering are fish and the streets of Miami as the sea rises. It's quite a vivid story, and there are a few other stories here about sort of what we might expect to see here in Paris, but it's a fairly lucid package that I recommend.
Okay, so Fish in the Streets of Miami from the New Republic magazine.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, and Jack Cushman, what coverage would you like to give a shout out to?
I woke up this morning in Paris to the pleasant surprise of reading a piece from the Washington Post on their website by Joby Warrick, thanks to the National Security Archive, which had produced documents under the Freedom of Information Act from the earliest days of the first Bush administration. And it was really remarkable. More than 25 years ago, in a State Department memorandum saying that if the climate change of current predictions occurs, the consequences for every nation and every aspect of human activity will be profound. And it went on to say, we can't wait until all of the uncertainties have been resolved before we act to limit greenhouse gas emissions and to plan for the climate change we're already committed to. And it's just a reminder of how we've really frittered away 25 years pretending that there was a lot of uncertainty about something that was actually increasingly well understood. And we simply can't afford to go through Paris and end up with a non-resolution of the problem that locks us into another decade or two of activity, of inactivity, because time is running out on climate change.
So that was in the Washington Post, Jack?
Yeah, it was on the website of the Washington Post. Of course, I don't have the dead tree edition of the Post here in Paris, but Joby Warrick had a very nice piece about it that went on the website when I woke up.
Okay, so we'll be sure to link to that here at Your Call Radio, both of those stories that both Mark Shapiro and Jack Cushman mentioned. And Jack, I can't help but observe that that story that you just noted from the first Bush administration, which is, 25 years ago now, that parallels the blockbuster investigation that you and your colleagues at Inside Climate News recently did, showing that ExxonMobil also knew more than 25 years ago perfectly well that the climate science was solid and threatened unparalleled disaster on this planet, and yet they then went out and spent millions of dollars funding groups to deny that reality. So,
Mark, this came at a critical moment in that narrative that we've described, because in the 70s and early 80s, Exxon realized that as the climate signal emerged from the noise and as the science moved along, and they were very deeply involved in this science, that eventually the time would come when the policy gorilla would escape from the cage and they would face action on global warming. This kind of memo in 1989 was exactly the signal that Exxon needed to launch what became a long period of manufacturing uncertainty about climate. And as this memo says, we can't wait until all the uncertainties have been resolved before we act. And yet Exxon very effectively worked to emphasize uncertainty and to stave off actions that they did not think were leading to appropriate policies.
That's Jack Cushman. He's with Inside Climate News. This is KALW. We're doing our Friday Media Roundtable live from Paris with two reporters. And, of course, we'll be inviting you to join us a little bit later in the broadcast. The numbers are 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Mark Hertzgard. So, it seemed to me, Mark Shapiro and Jack Cushman, if you read the U.S. and the British coverage in the weeks and months leading up to this Paris Climate Summit, there's a certain predetermined quality to the meeting. The message that came through that media coverage, to me at least, was twofold. One, there will be an agreement in Paris, but two, that agreement will not honor the goal that the world's nations have set of limiting temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And the spin that was coming through those stories was that outcome is supposed to be seen as a success because it is so much better politically than the nations have done in the past, even though scientifically it doesn't work. So the heads of state have come and gone. They've laid out their programs. Does it look like that to you there on the ground? Is the summit unfolding the way that sort of Washington and London and the UN diplomats running it there, Cristina Figueres, who's the head UN climate official, is it unfolding in that predetermined way, or are there any surprises? Jack Cushman, why don't you start?
Well, one thing that I would note is that by the time these negotiations started, practically every nation on the face of the earth had made a promise about what it was able and willing to do about climate change. And so pledges have been made by 190-some countries representing more than 95% of the emissions. And some of these pledges are really quite ambitious, and others are less ambitious. But we're now able to add up what everybody brings to the table and say, is that sufficient? And the answer is no. It's not sufficient to bring down to 2 degrees Celsius of temperature increase by the end of the century. It's not sufficient to bring it down to 1.5 degrees for sure. But we now know where we have to go in order to go where the science is leading us. And the purpose of this treaty is to lock these nations into a process that will do as much as any treaty can hope to do, given political realities, to get us over the next decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, onto a more appropriate course. And so is that a perfect solution? No. Is it a failure? I don't think so. I think that when I look around these delegations, I see 40,000 people in Paris who are all committed to spending the next 5,000 days getting up every day and doing what it takes to, you know, do the best we can with the hand that we've been dealt here.
Let me ask a follow-up here. Yeah. Are you guys, as journalists, are you able to observe and listen to the diplomats as they are actually debating back and forth and doing the negotiations, or are those closed-door meetings and you kind of have to take their word for it later outside in the hallway? How does that work? Do you guys have real access to what's going on, Mark Shapiro?
Not exactly. It's somewhat sporadic. I mean, you have these kind of meeting groups, and actually it was a real debate In fact, there was an official request by the Japanese delegation to keep those meetings closed, which they have been for a while. Then they were kind of reopened again, I believe, at the request of the Malaysians. And now you're never quite certain which meeting is going to be open and which meeting is going to be closed. There's kind of some uncertainty there. So in answer to your question, you cannot exactly get into the heart of the negotiations, but some of the meetings are open, if that can possibly be vague enough to offer some insight. I think there's actually what we've reached and built on what Jack just said, which is completely right on. And I think now what you have is this, basically they're really getting into the nitty-gritty of how legally liable the signatories to whatever agreement there is would be. So, for example, there's been a really interesting and charged debate very recently in the last couple of days. As Jack mentioned, every country has submitted what they call these kind of plans to reduce emissions. They have this incredibly clunky UN name, which is Intended Nationally Determined Contributions, which is INDCs in the kind of UN lingo. And this is this whole, as Jack mentioned, this whole list of emission reduction commitments, which, as he suggested, would get us essentially down to 2.7 degrees. So even those commitments are nowhere near the two. What's interesting now is there's even a discussion by some countries which are pushing, particularly the European Union and a few other associated countries, who are actually pushing to remove the intended from that articulation and simply call them nationally determined contributions. This is obviously key because it's a question of, and this is part of the larger question, of how legally liable any of the countries are to hold to whatever agreement they come to. Is it an intended, meaning suggesting a goal, an aim, a target by which they would actually reduce their emissions, or you remove that simple word, one word, intended, and suddenly you have nationally determined contributions, which at least the lawyers in this kind of universe consider to be something more approaching kind of mandatory reductions. So we're getting down into that kind of level of negotiating at this time, and I'm not sure where that's going to go, but that's a big issue right now. And broadly speaking, you could say it's between the European Union, which I think is pushing for a stronger regime, in alliance, of course, with the G77, which has been very strong in this, the Alliance of Developing Countries, and the United States and a few other developed countries. That's one example of where we're getting to when it comes. Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, now this is obviously goes back to the Copenhagen Climate Summit in 2009, and coming out of that, the U.S. was kind of adamant that we're going to try it differently going into the future summits, and really the way to do this is that we should have voluntary measures from each country and try and work it out that way. So what's playing out in Paris now seems to be the U.S. vision, and yet every other summit has featured amazingly stark differences between the rich nations and the poor nations. And so, Jack Cushman, you mentioned briefly before about the 1.5 degrees Celsius target. That's what many poor and vulnerable nations want because they're already looking at their lands going under the water in some of these Pacific island states. Have you heard, are the negotiations grappling with that 1.5 degree target at all, or is that just being shunted to the side, Jack Cushman?
No, yes, they certainly are grappling with it. And I have to say, it's a mistake, even though we're Americans and we look at the world through an American lens, it's a real mistake to allow yourself to look at everything about these climate negotiations from an American vantage point. Because even though the United States is clearly largely responsible for the pollution so far that has gotten us 1 degree of warming already, there are many players and we're all in this boat together. So if you're the Marshall Islands, you're not going to be satisfied with a solution that leads your country to be underwater. And if you're India, you're not going to be satisfied with a solution that cuts off your access to fossil fuels as a means of social development when your average per capita emissions of carbon dioxide are 1 ton and the United States average per capita emissions are 12 tons. And so you have to hold open a certain perspective. I don't think that this is a United States-driven agreement. You know, India is playing a huge role in these talks. China is very influential. The European Union is leading. The United States is not leading. The European Union has been making much deeper and more ambitious cuts than the United States. And so the United States is a player because even though we only have 5% of the population, we give off like 20% of the pollution. And so we have our own role to play, and we have our own political constraints because of the position of the Republican Party in our political system. But this is not all about the United States. And France and Germany are appearing to be pretty open to the idea of at least making some nod to the idea that maybe 1.5 degrees of warming is more important or more significant than 2 degrees. The reality is we've already got 1 degree of warming, so it's hard to see how we can slam on the brakes that quickly. But these talks are meant to lead the world to where the science is pointing. And the science is saying that 2 degrees is meh, and 1.5 degrees for many people is vital.
You're listening to Your Call Radio here at KLW, a special edition of the Friday Media Roundtable. We're live to the Paris Climate Summit, where we're talking about the two-week meeting to try and bring the climate change crisis under control. And we're hearing from Jack Cushman, he's with Inside Climate News, and Mark Shapiro, who's the author of Carbon Shock, the book Carbon Shock, and is reporting for Newsweek from Paris. What kind of presence, I want to ask both of you, what kind of presence does civil society have at Paris? There are supposed to be, as you know, massive street rallies last weekend to send a message to the arriving heads of state that they had to show greater ambition in Paris and negotiate the kind of deal that is really needed to keep this a livable planet for today's children and tomorrow's children. But in the wake of the November 13 terrorist attacks, those marches were forbidden by the French government. And so how is civil society or is civil society able to bring its concerns to bear there inside the negotiating halls? Mark Shapiro.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because if you compare this to the 2009 Copenhagen summit, which admittedly was 6 years ago, Mark, you yourself were there, so you recall this, I'm sure. Civil society was very active. There was an enormous amount of activity within the negotiating confines. I think basically there are a lot of differences with this summit, many of which are positive, I would add. You have the United States as a major engaged player in these talks, not the major player, as Jack put that perfectly, but is nevertheless engaged and has some credibility because of the initiatives of the Obama administration. You, of course, have China, which is engaged on a whole new level, completely different than it was in Copenhagen and then just was a couple of years ago. So the dynamic is very different. The Europeans are also very aggressive. So there are differences on that score. There's no longer a sense of anybody has to convince anybody that climate change is very real. That's almost like this comical aside, and fortunately a tragic comical aside in the United States. But that said, the presence of civil society, the movement, the climate movement, I think is actually pretty limited within the confines of the place itself. I think there have been very strong measures put into place about who gets accreditation, so the presence of civil society within the negotiating center is pretty limited. I mean, there are a few side events here and there, but not quite as powerful. And of course, they're really restricted from their activities within Paris. There is a kind of a people's summit, alternative summit, a couple miles out of town, which I will be going to over the weekend to see what's happening over there. But I would say less engagement with civil society than I've seen in the past. That said, last thing I'll say about that is the civil society movement over the last couple of years has been so kind of enormous. And let's not forget, what we have here is the most transnational movement in probably the history of the world. And all across the world, massive demonstrations and concerns. And I think governments are coming here with at least that information as they move forward and try to deal with this.
Jack Cushman, what have you seen there with civil society? There was, I saw some pictures from earlier in the week where there were, I think, 10,000 pairs of shoes that were put out around the Place de la République because to try and show the people who couldn't march, this is what we would do if we could. And I think even Ban Ki-moon donated some shoes, and the Pope.
The image was really very moving, and we really need to take a moment and just thank the city of Paris for moving ahead in the way that they have with this conference at a time of great national distress in France. This is the kind of episode that we lived through in Washington and New York, and that we now see Paris in its own way suffering through terrorism. And so we see lots of police on the streets, but we also see the people of Paris going about their business as usual and hosting this conference with great spirit. And really, I think, gaining kind of the emotional support of the world in a way that has drawn people together at this conference. One of the things that I sense here is that there is a kind of can-do spirit at this conference where, despite all of the differences that people have, I really believe that these delegates and these participants from outside the delegations are all completely committed to somehow finding a way to get ourselves a world where we won't have to apologize to our grandchildren for what we've done in our lifetimes. And whether it's on the terrorism front or the climate front, I feel that France in particular and the world as a whole are really pulling together here.
I've seen some pictures of the Eiffel Tower there in Paris that has, I think, 100% clean energy sign on it, and then another one with the hashtag Love Earth projected there onto the Eiffel Tower. Is that still the case there in Paris? And do you sense that the people there in Paris are not just going about their business, as you mentioned, Jack, but supportive of what's happening with the climate summit?
I think Paris is very proud of being the host for this event. If this does turn out to be a turning point and a tipping point that takes us to a world where, bear in mind, the objective of this treaty is to get us to a point where later in this century there are zero emissions, effectively zero emissions of carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels, and where our use of forests and land management are done in a way that offsets the damage that we've been doing since the Industrial Revolution. This is a huge tipping point. This means trillions of dollars of each year of investment shifting from dirty fuel to clean fuel. And for Paris to be the scene of this is a historic moment for them. I think they must take a great deal of pride in that.
We are live from Paris at the Paris Climate Summit here on KALW. And we're talking to Jack Cushman. He's with Inside Climate News, the Pulitzer Prize-winning news organization that just had that blockbuster investigative scoop about ExxonMobil, and also with Mark Shapiro. He's filing for Newsweek and also is the author of the book Carbon Shock. And he teaches at the UC Berkeley Journalism School here in the Bay Area. So we will be right back to have another half hour of talk from Paris Live. This is KLW, Your Call Radio.
It is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to engage with us in conversation this morning if you'd like to join in. The toll-free number is 866-798-TALK. Toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or if you'd prefer to write your question or comment, you can post it at yourcallradio.org, yourcallradio.org. On that site, you'll also find links related to today's discussion. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, Inflection Point. Following that at noon today, it's the Tavis Smiley Show.
So welcome back. This is Your Call Radio. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar this week. And we have a special edition of the Friday Media Roundtable. We are live to the Paris Climate Summit, where we are talking with two of the 3,000 journalists who are there to cover the summit, and I would say two of the best. Jack Cushman is an editor and reporter with Inside Climate News, and Mark Shapiro is a veteran environmental reporter filing for Newsweek, and he's also the author of the book Carbon Shock. So we've been talking about the civil society there and the negotiations between the rich and the poor nations. I want to drill down a little bit more on that front, and then I also want to talk about pricing carbon. On the rich and the poor, in 2009 at the Copenhagen summit, that was the final straw that broke the camel's back, if you will, about getting an agreement there, which was that the poor nations simply refused to sign on to the deal. And there was a lot of very heated rhetoric about they didn't like the 2 degrees target. They also didn't like the fact that they weren't getting the kind of funding to adapt to climate change coming forward. And there was a famous quote from the head of the G77 delegation who said that the money you're offering us won't even be enough to pay for our coffins. So I'm wondering if both of you could speak. Is there a friendlier mood between the rich and the poor nations at Paris this time around? And how are they dealing with these questions, the key questions of funding for these third world countries who are going to need help adapting to the impacts of climate change? Mark Shapiro, why don't you start?
Yes, I mean this is essentially one of the fundamental questions that have always ongoing theme essentially in the climate negotiations. And actually, I would say that Obama actually said something that was significant, just to go back a couple days. And when Obama came here on Sunday, he actually said for the first, I think he gave a talk on Monday, essentially that he took responsibility for America's contribution to the greenhouse gas situation and then some level of responsibility for dealing with it, which is a fairly significant, at least symbolic kind of acknowledgement. So the question, of course, is how you channel money from the developed countries to developing countries. We had fossil fuels that we were able to use very, very cheaply over the last 180, 200 years, and now developing countries are need to start dealing with the fact that we're going to put constraints on these fossil fuels. What's interesting, I think, I'm not sure the relationships are super smooth. I think they're very highly charged. The G77 has been very assertive in the course of this conference, G77 being the developing countries. One of the interesting concepts to remember, and I think it's going to continue being a theme over here, is that there is a real insistence that whatever money is channeled to developing countries does not be considered anything even remotely linked to something like charity or something that the developed countries kind of provide in some gracious way to developing countries, that this is money that is owed to them. This is their argument. This is the argument. This is money that you owe us for essentially because we are experiencing the impact of something that you most largely caused. And this is I think it's actually coming up in the negotiations. It's basically how this aid, if you want to call it that, is formed and channeled to developing countries, this kind of concept is pretty central to the G77 position. Meanwhile, we can come back to this. There are these funds of money that are being talked about, the Green Climate Fund and the Green Environmental Facility, which really have nowhere close to the amount of money that were hoped. But nevertheless, there are billions of dollars that are being put into these funds to help developing countries adapt to this, to the extreme. And I think actually there's another thing that's happening. One is not only, you know, we're way beyond dealing with mitigation in developing countries, but the serious money for adaptation and to deal with the consequences that are happening now, that are happening right now. And you have floods, you have massive disruptions, you have disruptions of the food supply chains, you have the drought, a whole array of things that are happening now, and that is really high on the agenda.
That's Mark Shapiro. He's writing for Newsweek from Paris. And before I turn to you, Jack Cushman of Inside Climate News, let me just read one email that we got from one of our listeners. Stephen writes to say, quote, I'd like to recommend this past week's Living on Earth from Public Radio International, available as a podcast on November 27. Former NASA scientist Jim Hansen is interviewed, and he points out that the last time that the Earth was 2 degrees Celsius warmer than the geological record, sea levels were several meters higher. That translates into roughly 10 feet higher. And that, of course, would flood not only islands but major cities and displace hundreds of millions of people. So that's part of the argument of the developing nations. If you're in Bangladesh, for example, with their vast delta in the south of the country, then they're already feeling the impacts of sea level rise, making the earth there saltier and reducing their crop yields. So, again, this makes quite stark the rich-poor divide. So, Jack Cushman, going back to my very first question, where the spin going into this conference was that, yes, we're going to have some kind of an agreement coming out of the conference. Is that really so? Because if the money isn't coming forward for the third world countries to adapt to climate change, are they really going to sign on to this deal?
Well, I have to say these are profoundly difficult questions, and they're questions that not only deal with the divide between the rich and the poor, but there are intergenerational issues. There are many justice issues involved. There's essential issues of fairness. As the Pope made clear in his encyclical, there are moral issues involved. And I don't for a moment pretend that I have the answers to all of these intractable questions. I do think that as the delegates come together and try to do what they have to do next week, that it seems unlikely to me that the poor nations are going to say, we would rather suffer the consequences of climate change because we fail to find a path to reducing our emissions than sign on to an agreement that doesn't satisfy us in terms of who pays for what. And I think that as realists, they are also going to look at something that I heard Al Gore point out yesterday. Former Vice President Gore said there's a big difference between 0 degrees centigrade and 1 degree centigrade. At zero, you have ice. At 1 degree, you have water. And he said there's a big difference, too, between solar and wind being more expensive than coal or less expensive than coal. Because if solar and wind are less expensive than coal, then everybody's going to go to solar and wind. And he and I think, share the belief that because solar and wind and pollution-free forms of energy are becoming cheaper and cheaper, and because we're beginning to put the price on carbon that makes coal and dirty oil more and more expensive, that pretty soon it's going to get to the point where a country like India really no longer is interested in developing its economy based on coal. The coal industry in India is a horrible thing. You know, children go down into the coal mines barefoot and haul it up in baskets. And that's not the way to develop your economy. And so if we can transform the economies of the developing world and provide electricity to the poorest of the poor on a clean basis, that might actually turn out to be cheaper than doing it the dirty way, then I think this problem could be resolved. And that the trick here is to write a treaty that has bridge mechanisms in it to resolve these differences. And that's where we are this weekend. The drafts of these treaties, they're trying to put in the little bridges that will allow people to cross over these divides that have separated them throughout this process. And if they can pull it off, and if it's not imaginary, you know, if it's not unicorns, if it's actual progress to providing the third world trillions of dollars of investment and the capacity in their societies to take advantage of those investments, then that will be real progress. But it's not going to happen overnight, and it does require people to meet in the middle. And So that's what we're all holding our breath to see.
That's Jack Cushman. It's Jack Cushman with Inside Climate News. And I have to go to a couple of emails from our listeners, please. First, Art in San Francisco, and this is one for both of you guys, because it's a question about the media. He cites Paul Krugman's column in today's New York Times, which is very critical of the news media's failure to clearly blame the obstruction on the part of the Republican Party and their denial of climate change for why we are in today's situation. And Art in San Francisco wants to ask both of you, what more can be done by reporters to overcome climate deniers in the media? Mark Shapiro.
this notion that it's so funny, you're here for a week, and this notion that Republican Congress just becomes, I'm sorry, it just becomes so tragicomic. Of course, I know how serious a matter this is. The whole world is aware of the Republican Congress. The entire world is aware. I'm working both with I'm here in Europe, of course. I'm working with the Internews Environmental Reporting Network. A bunch of journalists have come over here from developing countries, from Africa, from Asia, from Latin America, who have no problem writing about climate change. And in fact, it's very funny because we in America, when you talk to, and you know this, Mark, and I'm sure Jack, you find out, your editor tells you, can you try to find a way to make climate change relevant to, you know, our readers, and, you know, give us a story, can you find us a human story? You know, this idea in speaking with a journalist who's coming from somewhere in Africa or Latin America is, they're so beyond that point, because climate change is transforming the very land that they live in, that they operate in, that their families are in, that their newspaper operates in. So this notion that somehow the Republican Congress, of course we know that. Of course, I agree with Krugman that basically, you know, there could be far more attention put on the Republican position, the preposterous nature of the positions that they take.
He's not just talking about the Republican Party, though. He's talking about the media giving the Republican Party, in effect, a pass on this and trying to pretend in the name of balance that both parties are equally guilty of these kinds of sins, which is pretty hard case to make in the case of climate change. Jack Cushman, what do you think that the media could be doing better on this front in the United States context?
Well, I'm not a media critic, and I think from my own standpoint as a journalist, I think that we at Inside Climate News hold climate deniers' feet to the fires pretty much as well as anybody. I would say this. As far as I know, the United States is the only representative democracy in the world that has a legislative majority that is actively trying to scuttle the climate agreement.
Yeah, that's what Krugman said in his column.
Mm-hmm. The entire project of the majority party in Congress right now is to persuade the world that any treaty that the United States signs onto is going to not be worth the paper that it's written on. And what can you do with a situation like that? Everybody else in the world, maybe with the exception of one or two oil despots, everybody else in the world thinks that this is a problem that urgently needs a solution. And the only way to change what a legislative majority does in a representative democracy is to vote them out of office.
Speaking of a solution I want to turn you guys to the question of pricing carbon. That is generally seen as widely agreed as the single strongest policy measure against climate change. And I must say, the idea of putting a price on carbon, on carbon pollution, has gotten some astonishing sign-on in recent months. It's now endorsed by literally a who's who of global heavyweights. You've got the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, four of the world's largest banks, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, even a few oil companies are now online for this to put a price on carbon. So how is that? Is there any sense that that could be happening in Paris? There was just a presentation yesterday of people promoting it. But I'm asking about inside the negotiations, in the text, or perhaps side deals between nations. Is there any sense of a carbon price coming out of this agreement, either a formal one or a de facto mechanism for getting to where you price carbon so that, as you said earlier, Jack, so that solar and wind are definitively cheaper than coal and other climate-destroying chemicals. Mark Shapiro, why don't you start?
I think first of all, you have I think it's possible that there would be a declaration of some sort. You know, whether it's binding or not is another question. But I think you're absolutely right, Mark, about the spectrum of institutions. I just came from a briefing right before this from the World Bank, and the representative there was talking about the urgent need for a price for carbon to basically trigger and facilitate this move forward. They know, as do all these other people you've cited, as do most of the world's economists, cite that the so-called free market system has unfairly favored fossil fuels for 200 years, and it's now time to rectify that to an appropriate price for carbon. There already is a price for carbon in many jurisdictions around the world, starting in California, of course, the whole European Union. New areas starting to actually impose carbon taxes, even in Alberta, Canada, home of the tar sands, which would have been the source of the Keystone oil, is now, with the new government, beginning a carbon tax in Alberta. And in numerous other instances, in Chile is now looking into the possibilities of a carbon tax, even in developing countries. Numerous efforts to impose this price. There are two things to just keep in mind on that. Number one, will they be uniform, and will this pricing mechanism kind of interact with one another? We have very different prices in different parts of the world, which could cause some real trade imbalances. But I think it's certainly the way the world is going. And two, and I think it's just very important when we talk about a price for carbon, when you look at these studies of those places that have imposed a price for carbon, whether through the market or whether through taxation, there has been no economic contraction as a result. So the argument against the carbon taxes is from the industry is essentially you're going to lose jobs, you're going to contract the economy. And there is absolutely no evidence, and I've actually looked for that evidence, to suggest that that is actually the case. In fact, it does the opposite, generally speaking. It expands the economic base.
Well, Governor Jerry Brown, that's the message of the Governor Jerry Brown, we're talking here from California. Yep. Governor Jerry Brown is bringing that message to Paris.
Yeah.
And he says, we in California, we have all three legs of the stool of climate policy. We've got, we're slashing our emissions, and we're keeping our economy strong and growing, and we're taking care of the poor, because 25% minimum of the revenues that the state of California gets from pricing carbon by law must go to the most vulnerable communities, such as the, for example, down in Los Angeles, where many communities, largely non-white and poor and working class people, are breathing in terrible amounts of pollution, same out in the Central Valley. So is that, has Governor Brown's message, have either of you noticed whether Governor Brown's message is having any resonance there in Paris? Jack?
Well, I don't know about Governor Brown's message, but I would reiterate that the key here in Paris is not that these negotiators are going to fix a price on carbon in the way that OPEC used to fix a price on oil. That simply isn't going to fly. But as carbon markets develop around the world, it is very important to tie them together and to rationalize them, kind of in the way that our stock markets around the world are tied together and rationalized as best that we can. And the reason for that is that if you do that, then the cost of addressing the emissions problem should go down, because people all over the world will direct their efforts to the least cost way of cutting pollution. And, you know, as a matter of economic theory, that works fine. As a matter of practice, it's extremely complicated and fraught with all kinds of ifs, ands, and buts. Let me tell you a little story. The UN here at the COP has provided a way for people to offset their carbon footprint from flying to the conference. And, you know, if you fly from New York to Paris, as I did, you give off about a ton of carbon dioxide. You know, this is a rough back-of-the-envelope calculation. And so there's a place you can go to buy some carbon credits and pay off your ton of carbon emissions. So on a $900 ticket, what do you imagine it costs me to pay off my carbon footprint?
Well, $20.
Less than the cost of a baguette on the corner in Paris.
Is that right?
$1.75 to offset that. And so I thought, well, maybe I should just offset my whole carbon footprint for everything I do for the whole year. That would cost me about $20. The lesson from this is, and what I was buying was wind credits for a wind farm that had been built in India and that had been rigorously scrubbed through the Kyoto Protocol process, and that these are considered bona fide carbon reductions. Well, at $1.75 a ton, you know, I probably ought to just write a check and write off my whole family's carbon footprint and help build some windmills in India. But the problem is these prices are too low. Those are kind of trash credits, and you're not really accomplishing anything if you write a check for $20, $30, $40 and absolve your conscience of your lifestyle and don't do anything else in your actual life to turn down the thermostat, to put insulation in your house, to buy a more efficient car, to keep your tires inflated, to take mass transit, to do all the things that Americans need to do in order to bring our 12-ton per capita emissions down to something more like the rest of the world does. And so until you rationalize this system, and it'll take 10 or 20 years to do it, carbon pricing is, you know, it's something that needs to be done. It's a system that needs to be built, but it's not something that the UN can just, you know, put a carbon tax on every product that the world uses. That's not the way to do it.
Let me go quickly here to Mark Shapiro on this, because you've written your book Carbon Shock and studied this a lot. It sounds like, from what Jack says, that we're not going to have a carbon price written into that agreement, but perhaps that will nevertheless be a result that comes out of the summit. I've talked to certain activists and economists who say that as long as this summit sends a clear message that the world is moving away from fossil fuels, that helps encourage various jurisdictions impose a carbon price down the road. Is that a valid point of view, Mark Shapiro?
Yeah, I think that is, actually. I think that is. When you look, you know, the fact that China now is moving towards a national carbon price in China, already has markets set up in seven of the most industrialized provinces of China, which I want to point out that China is now the second largest carbon market. You've got California, China, European Union. This is enormous market. And for Americans, you may not know this, but this is the case. It's in the seven most industrialized export-oriented provinces, which means we Americans that import goods from China are already paying a carbon price. It's very small at this point, but it is a carbon price. So this should be a little less scary as we go along because we're already paying it. I actually want to what's interesting, number one, is I think it's happening all across the world, and actually the UNEP has actually done some studies. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of countries that are either moving towards a market situation or a tax situation. And while we're talking about this question, just a quick point. I think that the focus on the agreement, very important to be thinking about the agreement, but there is an enormous amount of energy, a huge amount of energy that's happening right below the surface of this kind of geopolitical negotiating. And one of the things to keep in mind is the enormous shifts in the financial industry and the calculations that major businesses are coming to when it comes to the enormous risks that are now being understood and seen when it comes to fossil fuels. And there was a discussion, an event within the negotiating halls yesterday. Al Gore introduced it. Then there were a whole array of top officials from major financial institutions and banks, all of which were talking about the enormous risk that they're starting to see from fossil fuels and how they are steering investors away from fossil fuels because of the enormous risk, both from a price for carbon, but also because of the technological advances, the increasing efficiency, the increasing competitiveness of renewables, which is actually creating enormous financial risk from fossil fuels. Two quick things on that. Today, this is news out of today. which is that the head of the Bank of England, which is the Federal Reserve Bank of the UK, enormously influential in world financial markets, just announced an effort with former Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York to actually initiate a serious study of the stresses that major financial institutions, both in Britain and elsewhere, or tied to Britain in some way, have in relation to fossil fuels. This is a whole new development just happened today. And so all across the board, you have shifts in the way that kind of major financial institutions are beginning to understand, one, the potential of renewables, two, and the dropping performance of fossil fuels. And that's going to start moving money away from fossil fuels, which is part of the point.
So what I hear here is that this shift at the financial level is happening, and it perhaps will get a bit of added momentum out of the Paris Agreement.
Yes.
We're getting in the very last minute of the show here. Can I just quickly have Jack and Mark Shapiro, Jack Cushman, can you start, Jack? What's the one or two stories you're going to be looking at over the next week? And then Mark Shapiro, but very quickly, please.
Well, I think for me, the next thing that I will be writing about is the role of India. I think that India is a very special case, and there's been a lot written about it, but I think that we're going to see India flex its muscle in the way that China has, and that traditionally the Europeans and the United States have dominated this discussion.
And Mark Shapiro? What's your next story?
I'll be writing about this new understanding that I think is coming clear here about the nature of financial risk and as it relates to climate, and I'll also be doing some stuff and some very interesting new technologies for monitoring both CO2 emissions, but also the state of forests and their ability to sequester CO2.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there on this special edition of Your Call. We've been live to the Paris Climate Summit. We'll continue to follow this story here at KLW. We've been speaking with reporters Jack Cushman and Mark Shapiro. Thanks, both of you, for joining us. Thanks, everybody, for your emails and phone calls. I'm sincerely sorry we couldn't get to all of you. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. On the next Your Call, we kick off a week-long series on climate change by discussing sea level rise in the Bay Area. Even if the Paris Climate Summit leads to a breakthrough, rising sea levels are coming, and they'll have a significant impact on the Bay Area. Where are we most vulnerable? How do we prepare? And who takes responsibility for a regional plan? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Hanna Baba and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.